In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If you think back to Sunday school, you probably remember the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not have any gods before me. Thou shalt not steal. Honor thy father and mother. Thou shalt not miss the I Spy radio show. And so on. You've probably also heard of the 11th Commandment. It's often attributed to Ronald Reagan, but in his autobiography, Reagan said this: "The personal attacks against me during the primary finally became so heavy that the state Republican chairman of California, Gaylord Parkinson, postulated what he called the 11th Commandment. Thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican. It's a rule I followed during that campaign and have ever since." You know, society would be better if it remembered the 10 Commandments. Republicans would be better off if they remembered the 11th, because right now conservatives are angling to put Hillary into office with their attacks. On today's show, we're going to look at some issues that are near and dear to the Trump campaign: persuading Democrats to switch their support, illegal immigration, and how to deal with bloated federal agencies like the TSA. And then in the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Reagan, columnist, author, speaker, and of course, the oldest son of Ronald Reagan. We'll not only talk about his new book, Lessons My Father Taught Me, but get his thoughts on Donald Trump. We're in a very different political world now. What would Reagan think? But also, what are lessons he'd want to share with today's candidate? Stay tuned for that. First up, I'd like to welcome Brendan Kirby. He is a senior political reporter for LifeZet, Laura Ingraham's news site. That's LifeZet.com. LifeZett.com. Brendan, it's good to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Yeah, before we get going, tell our audience a little bit about LifeZet. What sets you guys apart, you would say, from Breitbart or Right Wing News or some of these other sites?
Well, sure. Yeah, it's a crowded market, as you know, conservative websites. And I think what sets us apart is that we do a lot of politics for sure, but we have a lot on the pop culture. We have a lot on faith and religion and parenting. Laura Ingraham likes to describe us as a lifestyle site with a little bit of politics on the side, and I might be overstating it a tad, but I think there's a lot to that.
That's true. And the other thing that I like about you guys is they're really kind of short, quick pieces that you can read in just a few minutes. They're not some of these. I mean, on some of these, that you get into such long, long articles. I mean, it's hard to even finish them. You guys have some really great punchy articles, and so I really recommend people go check you guys out. You also had a very fascinating article there on the deal that Cruz should have made with Trump prior to the Indiana primary.
Yeah, I think I remember that one.
Yeah, well, anyway, that was mine. So, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com if people want to check that out. It's a little late for that, unfortunately, but it's a deal he should have made, I think, quite frankly, and get himself on the Supreme Court, there for life, not just two terms as presidency. But anyway, we're here to talk about your articles, and you've got one up there right now. It's Trump Turning D's into R's. And this covers the phenomenon of voter switching in states like PA, Florida, and others. Is this solely due to Trump, or is it an overall dissatisfaction with the Democrat Party, you think?
You know, I think it probably varies state to state. Trump certainly has a lot to do with it. I think there were a lot of people who were registered Democrats or even independents in states where the primaries are closed that wanted to vote for Trump, and the only way to do so is to switch parties. And that seems to be the case in Pennsylvania, where the Republicans this year picked up a net gain of almost 47,000 new voters when you factor in the Republicans who went to the Democrats and the Democrats went to the Republicans. But it's been going on, at least in Pennsylvania, for a number of years now. Wow. Going back to 2008, the Republicans have had a net gain in more than 112,000 party switchers. So I think that it's something that accelerated right around primary time, but we've seen it in Florida, we've seen it in Arizona, we've seen it in Pennsylvania and some other states. It's longer than just 4 years or you know, this year in the primary. And I think when Republicans are looking at where are the states that we can flip, they look at signs for enthusiasm. And I think that's what they're hopeful for in Pennsylvania.
Still a big deficit, though, in terms of Democrat voters versus Republican. It's like a million voters, isn't it?
Yeah, it is big. And I actually grew up in Pennsylvania, so I'm pretty familiar with it. It is a state. It's a very interesting state. It's sort of a microcosm of the country. It's pretty big and diverse. And Republicans, despite that disadvantage, hold their own quite well. They have a majority in the state legislature. They have a majority of the House congressional districts. And they do a pretty good job winning statewide elections in off years when the turnout is lower. What happens to them in presidential years is you get a big turnout in the cities of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. The minority turnout is much higher, and that tends to swamp the Republican vote. And it's, you know, it's sort of like Lucy holding the football at Charlie Brown, because every 4 years, Republicans look at Pennsylvania and they say, you know what, that's a state we can take, and they put a lot of resources into it. And it seems like every 4 years, like clockwork, it results in about a 5-point victory for Democrats. And what Republicans are hoping that this time might be different is the Trump factor, his appeal to working class voters. He tends to outperform in the coal regions and steel regions of Pennsylvania. He did very well in the primary there. And so the hope for Republicans is that he can get some normally Democratic voting residents in western Pennsylvania, and that would overcome the deficit that he would have in the suburbs. And we'll see if that plays out. But you look at the party switching trends, and you look at the turnout in a lot of states that exceeded the Democrats in the primaries, and Republicans think they have the enthusiasm factor on their side.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think right now the enthusiasm is on Trump's side. So he's saying he's going to put states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and California, New York and New Jersey all into play. Looking at those states, would you agree with him?
Well, let's just put it this way. If he puts California in play, that probably means it's going to be a Republican landslide. I think that's going to be a stretch for him. I think New York's going to be a stretch for him. And again, if those are states, if Trump were to win those or even make it close enough where the Democrats have to spend a lot of money to defend them, then that's a sign that the whole rest of the country is going that way as well. I think that's going to be tough. More realistic is, well, you take a look at the big true swing states, Florida and Ohio. Trump almost certainly is going to have to win those. And then if he does, he's going to have to move beyond that and look at some other places he can win. And that's why you look at Pennsylvania. You look at Wisconsin is a state, perhaps. Michigan would sort of be on the outer edge of that, but there are certainly a lot of working class voters there. I think those are the battlegrounds, and those are the places where this election is going to be won and lost, because just turning Florida and Ohio is not going to be enough. He needs more than that. And I think of the blue states, those big industrial states are much better targets for him than a state like California and New York, where the partisan registration is just so far towards the Democrats.
Yeah, and I think that's very correct. The one caveat that I would add to California is that I think that they tend to be swayed by big names and big personalities, and he certainly has the name recognition, certainly is a big personality, so maybe that'll come into play. Let's go ahead and take a break right here now. Lots more to talk about with Brendan Kirby, senior political reporter for LifeSet. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, helping you get a little more intelligence on big government. We're talking with Brendan Kirby, the political editor for LifeSet. That's Laura Ingraham's news site, Life Explained. If you've never been there, I would certainly recommend going there. And we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for the show notes for this week's show. That is 623. So just a follow-up question there from that last segment. It's interesting to me that Bernie seems to actually poll better against Trump than Hillary does. What would you attribute that to, you think?
Well, I think that has to do partially with the fact that he's the underdog. So he has not really been fully vetted, I think, with the American people. Hillary Clinton has tussled with him a little bit, but she's mainly tried to keep the gloves off because she's looking toward the general election and she doesn't want to alienate his voters. Were he the nominee, he would get the full brunt of the Trump assault and the Republican assault, and his ratings would probably come down from there. I think that's part of it. And part of it, I really think, is Hillary Clinton is just a pretty disliked figure among Republicans for sure, but even independents and even a lot of Democrats that I know and I've talked to, they'll vote for Hillary Clinton because they're Democrats, but they're not exactly enthusiastic about it. And so I, you know, and Bernie is just sort of a likable guy, and he's got these quixotic views, and as long as it looks like he's really not going to be the nominee, I don't think people really scrutinize them as much. So I think that is what's going on there.
Did you see that article that came out earlier this week that showed that something like 62% of Democrats would still vote for Hillary even if she was under indictment?
I didn't see that, but it doesn't surprise me. We have a term in the South called yellow dog Democrat. And that refers to the fact that there's a whole generation of Democrats who would vote for a yellow dog over a Republican if the yellow dog had the D by its name. And you know, I think that that pretty much applies nationally. And there's a Republican version of that as well. So we're just a very polarized society, and people kind of line up on their teams, and you know, they support whoever they support. It's really not hard to understand. You can be disappointed or not like your person, but when you contemplate the alternative, you know, it goes against everything you believe in, you know, all of a sudden, you know, maybe an indictment doesn't seem quite as bad.
Really? So you've got another great article up there on illegal immigration titled Massive Flow of Illegals into the U.S. And you cited a study by Stephen Camerota, who analyzed data from the Census Bureau. And in it, roughly 3 million immigrants entered the U.S. in 2014 and 2015, of which 1.1 million of those were illegal. I mean, that's the really astounding number when you think about it. That's the equivalent of Wyoming and Vermont's population here illegally. This is also a 15-year high. But, you know, maybe it's just me, but isn't it just a tad concerning, if not outright terrifying, to know that there's over a million new illegal people here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge number, and it's obviously not a new story. It's been going on for a long time, which is why, you know, both legal and illegal immigration, it's why we now have 45 million people or so in this country that are foreign-born. That is the highest number that it's ever been in our history, and we're on track by the year 2020 to have the highest percentage of the population foreign-born ever. I mean, you think about the great immigration waves that we've had at various times in our country. We've never hit the percentage that we're going to hit soon, and it is disconcerting. And especially when you look at these numbers that Stephen analyzed, which have been going down. You know, we had that great recession hit, and a combination of that and some changing demographics in Mexico slowed the flow of people from Mexico greatly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people said, hey, see, look, we've got control of the border. You know, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. The immigration system is fine. And what it turned out to be was a temporary lull because of the economy. Now our economy is improving again, and the arrivals have spiked back up. And the interesting thing is not from Mexico so much. They're still coming from Mexico, but in much smaller numbers. Now we're starting to see much greater numbers of other South and Central Americans. You think of those migrant children that have been coming.
And, China also, too.
Right, and China. The big increases from people from Asia. And the Asians tend to be more skewed toward legal immigrants, and they, you know, people who are coming, say, on a student visa or something like that, and then they find a way to stay, whereas the Central and South Americans are more likely to be illegal immigrants. But the impact is similar on the culture. You know, what CIS and others argue is illegal immigration obviously has its own set of problems, but even legal immigration, if you are swelling the ranks of, in many cases, a poorly educated population who don't speak English, there's big-time assimilation problems.
Yes.
And also competition for low-wage jobs with American citizens.
Yeah, and that's the problem that I continue to have, not just with illegal immigration, but immigration in general. I mean, if you're here to assimilate and become part of our culture and part of America, that's fine. I'm more than happy to welcome you. But so many of them, it seems, are here not for that at all. Plus, you've got the fact that we've got, what, 96 million Americans still out of work, and yet we're opening the floodgates to these immigrants. And it seems to me we ought to maybe start putting our own people to work before we do that. We only got about a minute here or so with you. I still have people telling me there's no difference between Hillary and Trump. And so on this issue, Trump has been very clear. He said he'll build a wall. He'll make people come here legally. He'll stop this unchecked Muslim immigration until we know who they are and so on. So is Hillary's approach to illegal immigration going to be just like Trump's?
No, I mean, I think Hillary's approach to immigration is going to be just like President Obama's. There really hasn't been any difference between the two. In fact, if anything at all, Hillary has said she would go further than President Obama on things like his executive action on legalizing whole classes of illegal immigrants here in the country now. Her criticism of President Obama is that it stopped short of what she would do. So I think on this issue in particular, there's a very big difference between.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we'll have more with Brendan Kirby, the political editor for LifeZet. That's LifeZet, ZETTE.com. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Brendan Kirby. He's the political editor for LifeZet. You can find that at LifeZet.com. And we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And so the other thing that we want to talk to you about is just this bureaucratic bloat that we've got going on here in the federal budget, federal government. Our budgets tend to be about 25 to 30, sometimes 40% deficit. So it seems to me that's the number we really need to start targeting, to start cutting back, just to get back to breaking even here. So Trump has famously said that he wants to start cutting inefficiency and heavily bureaucratic agencies. And although TSA, I don't believe, is on the chopping block, I can see where it might be considering the mess that it's been of late. This does not mean doing away with airport security, of course. It means finding other than federal solutions, including private business, which is actually how we used to do it before the TSA. So here we've got the TSA with these long lines. We've got the VA with similar problems. Has research pointed, in terms of your article, what were some of the solutions that maybe you had uncovered that Trump might now actually want to use to clean up this mess?
Well, if you go back and just take a look at the history of the TSA, as you mentioned, this used to be private security used to handle this. And then 9/11 happened and everyone freaked out. And the 9/11 Commission issued a bunch of recommendations. And one of the things Congress did when they created the Department of Homeland Security, they said, we're going to federalize this. So almost every airport now, these are federal employees under the TSA. And one of the very interesting things I found out when I was looking at this is the 22 airports that still use private contractors, there have been no complaints this summer about long lines or delays or missed flights. So it's certainly something to consider. I talked to Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, and she made the same point. She said maybe it's time to privatize the TSA. She had sponsored legislation a few years ago that would have taken the badges and the police-like uniforms away from TSA officers because, in fact, they're not sworn law enforcement officers. I think a lot of people don't realize that because of the way they're dressed.
That's right.
But they are they're customer service agents, as the Congresswoman says. So she wants them dressed as such, and she wants the security to be handled by sworn law enforcement officers. And you know, whether it means better management or I think it's so often the case, better management can be done by the private sector. I think it's certainly something to consider because the lines are long. And at the same time, according to the Associated Press, there's a breach in an airport on an average once every 10 days of somebody jumping a fence or tunneling under a fence, getting into a restricted area. So it almost seems like the TSA is holding up the people who are just regular travelers,
yes,
and we're not stopping the people who are not supposed to be in there.
Yeah, they're harassing the grandmothers rather than the actual terrorists. You know, it's interesting in your article there, you talk about a couple of things. Number one, the fees have gone up astronomically that TSA is charging passengers. It amounts to almost $4 billion. But then on top of that, there was a U.S. Travel Association survey that found that it's essentially costing a $4.3 billion hit to the industry above what the fees are due to possible people skipping summer travel, using other modes of transportation, and so forth. And so this is a $9 billion hit to the overall economy when you think about it.
Yeah, this is from a survey from the U.S. Travel Association where they asked people, given these lines and the hassle of flying, are you going to change your summer travel plans? And a good portion of them said they would either use another mode of transportation or just skip travel altogether. And yeah, right now the airlines are enjoying a pretty nice rebound. There's a lot of flyers. That's one of the reasons why there's the lines in the first place. But to the extent that people decide not to travel over the summer or decide to drive instead of fly, it could be a massive hit to the airlines. And you know, of course, every time we buy an airline ticket, you know, they take a chunk out of security fees right there.
Yes.
And what the union says, and I think there's probably something to this, that money is supposed to go into security, and Congress has diverted a portion of it for other things. And this is part of the budgetary shell games that Congress plays all the time.
Yeah. Of those 22 cities that you mentioned, are any of those like major cities, or are they kind of smaller independent markets?
Yeah, they tend to be smaller cities, but San Francisco is one. So that's obviously a very big airport. And there are a couple others that are a pretty good size. Mostly they are smaller markets. And, you know, I think that tends to be the case. You know, there's not as many people and you can usually get in and out of checkpoints faster, but certainly San Francisco is not a small airport. So,
no.
When the airlines ran this themselves, they had an added incentive to get people through fast because canceled flights is not good for business.
No.
And when it's a government, you know, a government agency doing it, they don't really, I think, have the same focus on doing that because to them, I'm sure they don't want people to miss flights, but if they do miss flights, it's not affecting their bottom line.
So in terms of efficiency, what are some of the fixes here? Have they ever thought about maybe making each airline responsible for their own security systems?
Well, like I said, that's what they used to do before we federalized everything, and I think this just got swept up in the aftermath of 9/11. The government, that's where the whole Homeland Security Department comes
sure.
from. We reorganized a huge amount of the federal government, and it was a reaction to this, you know, devastating terrorist attack we had. And you can debate whether, you know, rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic made us any safer than we were with all of the existing agencies that were just wearing different hats and under a different leadership structure. That might be a discussion for another day. One of the things that can be done, and I think that, you know, they tried to get more people to do, is to pre-board and pre-check in and sign up for that. And there have been relatively few passengers who have done that. If they could get more people to do that, it would probably speed things up.
I think incentivizing the correct behavior might be a good idea too. I mean, create $1 million federal bounty for each terrorist caught, that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
All right. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Brendan, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Go ahead. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, absolutely. And he is with LifeZette.com, LifeZette.com. And coming up next, Michael Reagan and his new book, Lessons My Father Taught Me, and maybe some lessons for this generation's Republican nominee. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We have a very special treat for you now, Michael Reagan. He's an author, speaker, columnist, and of course, you know him as the oldest son of Ronald Reagan. He has a new book out, Lessons from My Father. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. It's a real honor.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate being on.
Yeah. You know, overall, I enjoyed this book very much, and you're talking to a former book editor, and some of what I especially enjoyed about this was that you remind your readers about aspects that people may have forgotten or maybe even never heard. For example, your dad is often portrayed in the liberal press as just an actor, but people may have forgotten that he majored in economics in college. I know I forgot that. Does that catch people off guard, you think, when you mention that?
Well, I mean, the reason I wrote the book is really to get away from people knowing him only as, you know, in the political realm as President of the United States or Governor of California, but on the personal level, who he was and what he was, you know, to a kid who 20 years rode out with him to the ranch, you know, being told every story known to mankind. And again, to be able to tell the story, to me, he went to Eureka College. He didn't go to Harvard, he didn't go to Yale, and he went there on a poor person's scholarship because he didn't have enough money to be able to go to college. So he was able to get a scholarship, you know, to be able to go, and ended up getting an economics degree. I think many people who serve in Washington should be able to have an economics degree. They don't.
Yeah, it should be required to hold office, you would think.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah, one of the things required do you have any economics degree? Thank you very much. You go from there.
Yeah, or even just the notion of being able to do basic math. I mean, anybody that could do basic math could have figured out that Obamacare was going to be an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
In the book, you also mentioned that your dad created a facade of a chief executive who delegated everything and took a lot of naps. And I remember one time, you know, because I grew up in the Reagan era, and I didn't ever get a chance to vote for him, unfortunately. I didn't turn 18 until 1985. But I remember one time watching a news report, and the reporters were just aghast that your dad had nodded off in a cabinet meeting. And, you know, to hear them go on about it, it was like your dad had fallen asleep and his head hit the nuclear launch button.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think your dad ever pretended to fall asleep to create that facade?
Oh, very well could have. I mean, it just, he knew how to play, he knew how to play the press.
Yes.
And he knew how to use the press. I mean, in the book, when I tell the story about the hostages coming home on the day that he was sworn in, and everybody just goes, wow, look at what Iran did. They let the hostages go. But if you go back and look at the campaign of 1980, the liberal left did nothing but tell America that he was going to start World War III. He was going to turn Iran into a parking lot, going to turn it into a glass factory. He's going to hit the red button as soon as he got the nuclear codes. But you'll never hear a speech of Ronald Reagan denying any of the things that are being said about him by the left, because he understood his audience. And he knew the audience was also overseas in Iran holding hostages, and they were listening as well as anybody else. And I'm sure part of the reason that those hostages came home on the day my dad was sworn in was because they didn't know if Ronald Reagan was going to push the button, turn him into a parking lot or a glass factory. They had been so told that by the liberal left. So he was able to really understand the medium and use the press. He had fun with the whole falling asleep thing. He made jokes about it. And one thing about my dad, he never really got angry. He never took things personally. Nancy did, but Dad never did.
Hmm. Well, and that is one of the things that I really so much enjoyed about your book is that it did such a great job of personalizing him. And, you know, I've heard a lot about the strong influence that your dad's mom, Nell, had on him, especially raising him as in a good Christian household. But I really enjoyed your insights into the influence of your dad's own father, Jack, and how the government killed, you know, for example, how the government killed incentive for work in the middle, you know, right in the middle of the Depression, that your dad learned the art of storytelling from his father, work ethic, and also in a bad way, Jack's struggle with alcohol. What can you tell us about Jack and your dad's relationship with him?
Oh, Dad and Jack had a really great relationship. You know, and Dad was the protector of the family. They dragged him off the doorstep of the house and brought him inside. You know, Jack, I think at one point, they were expecting a bonus. He was a shoe salesman, a bonus on Christmas Day. The mailman actually came, knocked on the door, and instead of getting a bonus, he got his pink slip. Got fired on Christmas Day and went through a lot of troubles that way. But he was able to sit there and really take his son, Ron, out and teach him. The story you're talking about is the fact when he's telling his son, Ron, that, you know, he can't find people to go to work anymore in the jobs that are available because they're now paying them not to work. And he told to Ron, his son, he said, you know, when they start paying people not to work, why work? And my dad would tell that story to me. You know, one of those rides out to the ranch one day, he would tell me the story of Jack. He would tell me that story and say to me, you know, when they start paying you not to work, why work? And you look at the problems we have now today in the world that we live in America, people are making more money staying at home not working than if they went and they got a job. And so it all came full circle from what Jack told his son, Ron, to what his son told his son, Michael, to where we are today.
Yeah. Your dad was also known as the great communicator, but it seems like, you know, in reading your book that there were times that maybe he struggled communicating with his own kids. What were some of the things that you think that your dad stumbled over and when it came to communicating things to you and your siblings?
Well, you know, the thing is, Dad always wore the white hat in the house. He always let Nancy or my mom wear the black hats. They were the disciplinarians. You were scared to death to go in the house if you did something wrong with the moms there. Dad was a good guy. And I think that, you know, he had trouble sometimes really relating to the kids. discuss. You know, he would call me sometimes when he's having troubles with Ron, you know, relating to him. I think he called me this one time. He said, you know, I can't relate to him. I don't know what to do. Maybe you can help me. And I went over to my dad's office and he was talking to me. And I'm trying to think, what do I say to him? And so I had him draw a line down the center of a piece of paper, and he did. And I said, put football on one side, baseball on the other side. And he did. And he kind of looked at me. I said, now write down the number of times you're taking your kids to a football or baseball game. And he realized at that point in time, he never had.
Mm.
And I said, we've gone to the ranch with him on so many occasions, but he'd never gone to a baseball game with us. And part of that really comes down to, again, you know, he couldn't just go to a baseball game and sit there and enjoy a game without people coming up, tapping him on the shoulder. Can I get an autograph or what have you? And I really think part of that was, you know, he was afraid to go and be in the public around with his kids because he really couldn't be with them when the public would see him.
Right, right.
And be signing autographs and all those things. I think that was part of it in the back of his mind on that level. It really is, Steve. He wanted to communicate with Dad. The best place to communicate wasn't really in the house when Nancy was there or what have you, because that relationship the two of them have. If you want to communicate with Dad, you did it really the way, you know, I did. And I think maybe my dad felt closer to me because of those 20 years riding out to the ranch.
Huh.
You know, shooting ground squirrels, riding horses, chopping wood, painting fences, swimming in the afternoon, jeep riding all over the area. I mean, 20 years of those things. My sister had 24. So there was a different bond with myself and my dad than there was probably with my dad and with Patty and Ron, which I write about in the book also.
Yeah, because by then he was certainly much more in the public eye. Oh, okay, we are up against break. When we come back, we'll be talking about some politics, and then we'll get back into the book. Stay with us. And we're back. We're talking with Michael Reagan today. You know him as a radio host, columnist, author, and the oldest son of Ronald Reagan. His newest book is Lessons My Father Taught Me. And before we get back to your book, we really can't have you on without talking about current events and politics. Your dad is famous for popularizing the 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican. Although I think some conservatives would add, Reagan obviously didn't mean Donald Trump in that. But anyway, I suspect your dad might want Trump to tone things down a bit, or at least say things, you know, say the same things, but find more subtle, more less bombastic ways of saying it. But what do you think that he would make of Trump?
I think he'd probably be in many ways embarrassed by it.
Hmm.
Because my dad just wasn't that way. My dad wore the white hat. My dad made friends of enemies, not enemies of friends. I think Donald Trump makes too many enemies. I mean, like attacking the federal judge, which he's doing now on a regular basis. Why? And who does he turn off? He turns off the Hispanic population, which, whether he likes it or not, is a growing population in the United States of America. And many people today in America are related somehow to somebody of Hispanic descent. And so, you know, who are you pushing away? My dad just wouldn't do that. He wouldn't call the names of people because he would know that later on you'd have to go back to those same people and bring them together to move everything, in fact, forward. Another thing you wouldn't hear from my dad, you wouldn't hear the word I all the time. I did this. I've done this. Look what I've done. Ronald Reagan never said the word I. Mm. It was always we or us. He didn't worry also who got the credit. The placard on his desk, you know, no telling what a man can do or where he can go or what he can accomplish. He doesn't worry who gets the credit. You know, he never worried about who got the credit. He didn't care that Mikhail Gorbachev gets credit, you know, for the Berlin Wall. He doesn't care. The issue was, can we bring the Berlin Wall down? That happened. Give somebody else the credit. I don't care. We don't live in that kind of a world today. We have too many people saying the word I and wanting to take all the credit.
I think that's very true. I think one of the differences really between your dad and Donald Trump is I think they both inspire love by their followers. I think they both inspire love of country. But I think you're right. I think, unfortunately, Trump also inspires a lot of hate sometimes, both of himself and of his policies. And that's unfortunate that he's he's doing that. I do hold out some hope that he's going to start changing and start realizing those mistakes as people surround him, people with more political acumen get around him and maybe can help change that. One of the things he has to go ahead.
What he has to do is expand his audience past the 11 million people that voted.
That's right.
There'd be 120 million people probably going to vote in November. He's got to talk to that 120 million people also, instead of just talking to the audience in front of him. My father, as I write about in the book, knew his audience. He knew when he gave the Evil Empire speech, he wasn't talking just to that group in front of him. He was talking to the Nathan Schwerinskys of the world in gulags. When he gave the Tear Down the Wall speech, he wasn't talking to people in front of him so much as he was talking to people behind the Berlin Wall. And Donald Trump needs to understand that if he wants to get elected, he needs to go way past that 11 million people that show up to vote.
That's right. You know, one of the things I hear all the time by some conservatives that are still anti-Trump, they say my principles won't let me vote for Trump. Would your dad's principles stop him from voting for Trump?
I tweeted a few weeks ago at Reagan World, and the tweet was simply this. I said, this is no longer the party of Ronald Reagan. It's now the party of Donald Trump. Good luck. Because it isn't the party of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan probably today wouldn't even win the nomination of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But likewise, John F. Kennedy wouldn't win the nomination of the Democrat Party. John F. Kennedy would be too conservative. Ronald Reagan would be too liberal. And that's how the parties have changed. So would Ronald Reagan, you know, vote for Trump? I don't know. I really don't know. I will tell you this. Nancy wouldn't. And if Dad did vote for Trump, he certainly wouldn't tell Nancy.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. There were some a lot of similarities between your dad's race and with what's happening now. And in particular, this notion that conservatives like Bill Kristol and others are trying to go third party. And your dad faced something similar, actually, not in 80, but in 76, that the Draft Buckley campaign. And so what do you think he would think of Bill Kristol and these others trying to go third party?
I think he would have found it foolish. Absolutely foolish. It would be, as Wright's previous said, a suicide mission. And you have to agree with that. It's just, we already have a third party, and we got Bill Clinton. Do we now have another third party and get Hillary Clinton?
Yeah.
And so, I think he would find it very foolish and really going down the wrong, you know, type of a road. And he would also say the same thing to Donald Trump. I think you're going down the wrong type of road also. I don't think Ronald Reagan would be supportive at this point. I don't think he would have endorsed at this point, only because he's listening to the rhetoric having to do with the Hispanics and with Muslims and so on. My dad had great respect for people, and he wouldn't want to tie himself to somebody who may make him look like he might be a racist. And I think that's an important thing to understand. On the other side of the equation, people ask me, what would your dad do to handle ISIS? My answer has always been, he wouldn't have had to do anything because ISIS would not exist had Ronald Reagan been president of the United States.
That's right. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Coming up, we're going to be talking more about his book, Lessons My Father Taught Me. Stay with us. And welcome back to the Nice Bear Radio Show. We're honored to be talking to Michael Reagan, the oldest son of Ronald Reagan, about his latest book, Lessons My Father Taught Me. Available now, only $15.60, and that's hardcover. It's a real bargain, and Father's Day is on the way. I'd like to talk now about one of the chapters, Turn Defeats into Success. People only really seem to remember his successes, governor of California, president, and so on, but certainly he had his shares of setback. If there was one thing that you would attribute his ability to turn defeats into successes, what would you say that was?
Yeah, well, if there's one, there's probably very many as he goes. If you look at his life, you know, the fact when he got fired from General Electric Theater, and it's kind of interesting, Bobby Kennedy called the head of General Electric and said he didn't like that guy who was going around the country speaking about his brother and speaking about government. And if they wanted their new contracts or their government contracts renewed, it might be a good idea to find a way to get rid of that guy. And 72 hours later, General Electric Theater is canceled. And now Dad needs a job. And so he gets a job doing 20 mule train borax for a while, but he's not going around the country giving all these speeches anymore. So he has time to do a lot of reading, a lot of soul searching. He changes from a Democrat to a Republican, and he writes a new speech that he ultimately gives in 1964, in October 64, called The Time for Choosing, which completely changes his career and changes the Republican Party and politics for forever and ever. And it was Bobby Kennedy making that call. Bobby Kennedy doesn't make that call. Ronald Reagan doesn't have time to give a speech for, in fact, Barry Goldwater, because he's hosting a top 10 show every single Sunday night.
Yeah, that was, I think, one of the more surprising reveals there in the entire book. I had never heard that before, that the Kennedys had worked behind the scenes to get him fired. And ironically, as you say, it helped launch him into politics. So thank you very much, Kennedy clan. Did he ever talk
about look at the other side. When Dad's president of the United States, Caroline Kennedy and John come to the Oval Office mm-hmm. and ask if my dad would give a speech at Ted Kennedy's townhouse in D.C. as a fundraiser to open up the Kennedy Library. And my dad goes and he does that and gives that speech for John F. Kennedy's library. That was the first speech, the first fundraiser done for the Kennedy Library.
Yeah, and it's cool that he was able to reach out to the other side like that. It really shows the difference really maybe between then and now. I mean, that there wasn't the acrimony quite so much that is infusing today's politics. Did he ever talk to you about the dirty tricks involved that the Kennedys used the weight of the government to blackmail GE into stopping the show? And do you think those dirty tricks may have actually propelled him into changing parties?
Well, I think that probably was part of the help. I think my sister Maureen was the other part of the help, really pushing him. She was the first Republican, you know, really in the family and was always pushing my dad. But certainly it had an effect on him. Lost his job. I remember sitting at the dinner table with my dad and my sister Maureen and Nancy. We tell him he's not going to be on Sunday night. The show's been canceled. And we're like in shock. And he's the one that, the reason I know the story is because it's the story my dad told me at the dinner table, mm-hmm. along with my sister and along with Nancy. But he never let that stuff detract from him. He was always moving forward. He just, you know, he was like the Boy Scout, and running for the presidency was like getting his Eagle badge.
Hmm.
I mean, he was always that. Going out to the ranch, the stories he would tell going out to the ranch, he would sing every song of every military known to mankind, the Marine Corps, the Army, the Navy, the Coast Guard, Air Force, every one of them. And that's what he did. Driving out to the ranch any given Saturday and just telling stories about America, the greatness of America. He was a Boy Scout from the time I was born. It never changed.
Yeah. We've only got a minute here with you. Part of turning failure to success is dealing with criticism. How did your dad deal with personal attacks? And did you ever see anyone land a punch that really stung him?
No. He, you know, the thing is that Nancy worried. Oh, we and the family got upset. But he never did.
Hmm.
He never let something detract from the mission that, in fact, he was on. There's some great stories in there, you know, why he ran for president in the first place, he told me back in 1976, and some of the other stories that we tell. I tell you, if people are going to buy the book, one of the reasons you should buy the book, just to read the letter he gave me when I got married.
Yes, yes.
And that's a great letter for any wife or husband to read. And, you know, that marriage only lasted a year, the first marriage. And when I got married in 75 to Colleen, he came up to me after we got married. He looked at me and said, "You already have the letter."
Yes, that was very touching. And there are so many touching elements and stories that you relay here. I want to thank you so much for your time today. Michael Reagan, his book, one more time, Lessons My Father Taught Me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Father's Day is coming up, and this is a great book, not just for fathers, but also a book that fathers might want to give to their kids. Here, these are things that I felt, and maybe I didn't always do a good job of expressing. In closing, I'd like to read this from the book, from that chapter about turning failures to successes. Summon all of your creative energy and renew your determination, your courage, and your strength. Above all, renew your faith and your hope. As Dad would say, you have every right to dream heroic dreams. And that, I think, right there, is the essence of a Donald Trump candidacy. Dream heroic dreams. Obama has divided America down to its core, and yet he and Hillary blame Trump for the division? America has fallen on hard times. Every hero rises, again and again, and we will too. Sure, I wish Trump was more Reagan-like, but we're not in Reagan's America anymore. It's like we're in the 1960s with all of its riots. We need a strong leader to get us out of this and put us back on the right track. And Hillary will only make things worse. Be sure to check today's show page and share that with your friends, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.